Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
It's all about the macro productions.
Flashback Fridays here on Macro Aggressions, taking you back to November 21st, 2023. Blowback. If you want to turn some of your soon-to-be-worthless fiat currency into actual money, then check out my friend Tony Arterburn with Wise Wolf Gold and Silver. Set up a monthly buy with Wolfpack subscription as low as $50, or roll over your IRA and 401k into physical precious metals. You can even use your Bitcoin to make purchases. Go to macroaggressions.gold, promo code macro for free silver. Now, please enjoy the show.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Keith Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a lockdown.
I have sent 6 of my Libyan missiles to blow up the CS hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with 2 German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior.
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macro aggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macro Aggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Rumble, Band.video, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks so much. We appreciate the support. If you like the show, you can rate it. You can write a little review about it. If you want to connect with me, the website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. That's the best place to find my information. If you want to follow me on Twitter, at Macro Aggressions. Big thanks to the sponsors that make this show happen. My Patriot Supply was nice enough to build a landing page specifically for us called preparewithmacroaggressions.com. You can find that in the show notes below and go get yourself sorted out. Then get a month supply of storable food. You can get 3 months. You can get yourself set up in 10 minutes. You can hook up your family if they live out of state. You can just drop ship it to them. Listen, I think we have to be proactive and think about these things. Storable food is a good thing to buy you a little bit of time in case things get weird. And My Patriot Supply has been doing it for a long, long time. They'll send it right to your house. You don't have to freak people out. You can just tell them it's for hurricane, tornado, earthquake, whatever. You're just being prepared. Grab, it comes in buckets. Just put them someplace where you know where they are, out of direct sunlight, and they'll last you for 25 years in the event that you need it. So take some of your soon-to-be worthless Federal Reserve notes and convert them into storable food, I say, or at least take a look and think about it. www.preparewithmacroaggressions.com is the place to do that. Also, thanks to the folks over at EMP Shield. If we are being honest with ourselves, we are in a weird spot. the idea of another country, or maybe even our own country, setting off an EMP inside America used to always sound like, you know, the rantings of deranged conspiracy theorists. And now it seems like an option, a diabolical one, of course, but it does seem like something that could be in the cards for us, not just here in America, but anywhere. EMP Shield sells everywhere, all over the country. You can go to empshield.com and read up about it, find out what their products do, find out why the government was interested in what they were doing with these products and why they were working so well, not just against EMPs, but also lightning, solar flares, reasonable things like that. I think these are kind of natural events. We have natural and unnatural events that could happen. So EMP Shield will protect your car, your house, your boat, if you've got one, or RV or generator, things like that. You can get bundle packages. You can install it yourself if you are handy. There's installation videos on their site, or you can just have an electrician come out to your house and knock it out in a couple minutes. It installs with just four wires, like a type 2 surge protector. So it's relatively easy to do. The question is it something that you're interested in pursuing? EMPshield.com is the place to go. Promo code MACRO on your way out the door to save yourself quite a bit of money. Well, you know, I'm going to get into this Israel-Palestine thing because it has to be done, right? We have to kind of talk about this, but you know, also, I fully recognize this is a very polarizing topic, and it rubs some people the wrong way. I am anti-war. That's my position. That's always been my position. Anybody that's starting wars, I'm not in favor of. I'm also realistic, too. I understand that you can't just tell people, no, I'm sorry, we're not doing war here, and then have them listen to you. I mean, unless you're Switzerland. God knows what sort of arrangement with the world Switzerland has, you know, what sort of diabolical things are happening in that beautiful country, just under the surface of everybody. So, but for the most part, you know, listen, you're going to have, instances where you're fighting with your neighbors, potentially. In the United States, we're pretty fortunate. We've got great neighbors to the north in Canada. We have a wonderful group of people in Mexico that are, you know, it's being used as a jumping off point to infiltrate the country with a bunch of people from elsewhere. But the Mexican people themselves aren't really the problem. Mexican people are cool as hell. Oh, and by the way, they can use your help after the hurricane that hit Acapulco. Jeff Berwick's raising money. HurricaneOtisRecovery.com is the place to go. He's raised, as of the recording of this, damn near $500,000. They've been distributing it to with Sprinter vans to people in need in Acapulco. So if you are so inclined, HurricaneOtisRecovery.com is the place to go. I didn't mean to get sidetracked with that, but since I mentioned Mexican people, those are the Mexican people that need it, right? Those are the people, they're not coming to the United States. They're very happy being in Acapulco. I know why. It's great there. I don't blame them. So they're happy to be there. So, but not everybody. Not everybody is happy to be where they are. And so there's a lot of pushback. There's a lot of infiltration into countries. We're going to talk about that in the tail end of this. We're going to talk about what's being done to the United States. And it's not accidental. I think it's pretty obvious to anybody paying attention. It's not like somebody just woke up one day and they all had the same idea, but let's go walk to the United States. It's being made to happen. And there's a term for this. There's a term for this when you destabilize countries covertly, and then the general public figures it out that something's going on and they get angry. It's called blowback. Blowback is described from the dictionary as negative repercussions affecting a country whose government has undertaken a usually clandestine intelligence operation in a foreign country. When they catch you messing around in their country, they get mad. And that's called blowback. That's when it's covert. And that's, of course, what we're seeing here. Israel-Gaza situation, I mean, that is blowback personified. That is the epitome of that. That is a long history that predates all, you know, us being alive here. We're talking about 1917 Balfour declarations. national home for Jewish people. We're talking about that whole concept with the Rothschild connected Lord Balfour, talking about land ownership, the Rothschilds buying up as much of as they could of Palestine, and the Balfour Declaration basically gifting this to them. We have there's a lot more to it. You could do an entire episode on the Balfour Declaration. We won't, but just to understand, this isn't something new. This isn't some concept that, like, oh my gosh, Israel and the Palestinians are fighting all of a sudden. It's been going on for a while. And then of course the 1947 United Nations plan created massive tension. And if there's one thing I've learned over the years, it's that when it comes to geopolitics, especially in the aftermath of wars, when they're redrawing lines, national boundaries and borders, they tend to do it in a way that is incompatible with logic and reason, unless the stated goal is to create more tension in the area. Like when you carve up Iraq in the way that it is currently configured in the Middle East, you do so, the only reason you would do it that way is if you were trying to create tension. When you put groups that don't like each other in the same country, you could very easily have made it two countries. You get your part and you guys get your part here, and we'll call it Iraq North and Iraq South, and you guys can all have your own space. They don't want that. That would make far too much sense. That would make sense if you were looking for peace. They're not looking for peace. You have to take that out of the equation here. You have to make sure that you don't impose your assumptions onto these maniacs that are redrawing borders, because they don't want the same things. You say, oh, well, you're going to redraw it in a way so that these groups don't fight with each other. You're like, why would you think that? Of course, I want them constantly fighting with each other. How do you think our banks are going to make money lending them money? How do you think that our military industrial complex is going to find future wars to fight in? We have to keep everybody fighting with each other. So again, you have to look at this from their point of view and be careful not to impose your decency on them, because they don't want the things that we want. And it's pretty obvious. I mean, it's pretty obvious when you look at the creation of Israel in 1947 as a homeland for the Jewish people. You know, there's an interesting part of this that nobody really talks about, you know, with the whole, Adolf Hitler came to power and then he expelled all the Jews, and then they sent them all to Palestine. You go, well, not really, because at first they tried to and nobody wanted to go anywhere. And then eventually there were deals that were made and Palestine was settled as the place that they would send them. But it wasn't the first choice. You know what the first choice was? The first choice that was offered as a Jewish homeland? It'd be kind of weird if it played out this way, but Madagascar, an island off the eastern coast of Africa, was actually picked as the first option for a Jewish homeland. I'm sure the people of Madagascar were like, hey, maybe ask us first before you start volunteering our island for this Jewish homeland. But the problem is the Jewish people said, well, we have no sort of ideological anchoring in Madagascar. We don't, no offense, but like, it's not our homeland. It's not important to us. So therefore, thank you for offering somebody else's island to us, but we're not interested. Somebody wanted to put them on an island, like an actual island. You know what I mean? They're like, what if we rounded them all up and put them on, I don't know, Madagascar, someplace out of the way, right? But that didn't work. So it wound up being Palestine. And what we currently have now is an apartheid state. Let's be honest here. I mean, I know that the Israelis say, oh, well, we don't like to consider it that. Of course, you don't like to consider it that way, because the comparison is South Africa. And you saw how poorly the black people in South Africa were treated by the white minority. And you go, yeah, well, that's not us. We don't want to be associated with that. No, it is you. It's 100% you. You are an apartheid state. Just be honest about it. Be honest about something. That, I think, is the biggest problem that the external world has with this conflict in the Middle East. You just get nothing but lies. from both sides, really, but especially Israel, the way they view this situation that they're being in, that they've been put in, is deeply troubling for people that are humanitarians. The way that they treat others, the way they treat the Palestinians and call them insects and say that they are dogs and say that they are animals and say that this is what you do in world wars. In the lead up to these wars, you demonize the other side and make them less than human. Because if they're less than human, you can convince your soldiers to shoot at them. But if your soldiers are looking at the other side and seeing themselves in the faces of the enemy and saying, this guy looks about the same age as me, maybe we both like football, soccer. You know, maybe we have similar characteristics. Maybe I don't want to shoot this guy who's just over there because he got dragged into this thing the same way I got dragged into it. But if you can make them, and again, I'm not trying to put this all on Israel, because the United States did this in Japan. Turned all the Japanese propaganda towards Japan was they're monkeys. They're savage monkeys. You got to shoot them out of the trees in Iwo Jima and you know, Saipan and places that you've got to go in there and root them out, you know, in the Marshall Islands. They're crazed animals. And of course, you know, and then the Japanese were the counter propaganda was that they were propagandizing their troops saying the Americans will bayonet babies. You know, as soon as they come in here, they're wherever the island nation is, they would tell the local population, you know, when the Americans get here, they're going to bayonet all your kids. And so that's why you had people, locals that were jumping off of cliffs and into the ocean. You can see the videos of it. It's horrible. Mothers holding their kids and jumping off and killing themselves before the Americans came in because they were propagandized. So again, with regard to the Middle East, whether it's any war, one of the key components is propaganda. And you need to use that to destabilize not just the news, but also you have to condition the people to think that they are in a war against animals. And if you can do that, you've got them. So that's kind of where we are with regard to the situation in Israel. Who started it? You know, who fired first? Who cares? You know, this is there's been horrible shit on both sides. It is, you can find the shrinking Palestine map. Take a look at that. They'll show you four different versions of it. One in 1947, one in 1967, one in, I think, 1981 or somewhere around there, and one to present day. It's gone. The land that the Palestinians had is gone. They are on Indian reservations right now. Gaza and the West Bank. Gaza is geographically down towards the south, borders the ocean. West Bank is sort of the northern part, northeastern part of Israel. Geographically separated. So when you think of the Palestinians in Israel, or Palestinians in Palestine, or however you want to come at this, just know that that within this state, however you want to define it, the Palestinians are divided into two different sections that cannot connect with each other. There's no freeway. You know, there's no way to get from one to the other. So you're either here or you're there. You're either up in the north or you're down in the south. So you're isolated. Not accidental, but completely by design. Not even my speculation that it's by design. You can hear Benjamin Netanyahu talk about this. And that is extremely effective. If you can split your enemy in half, then you can slowly whittle away at them. So let's talk a little bit about some of the demographics and some of the numbers, because I like to get into that. And I think it helps to paint a picture of kind of what's going on when you hear Israel and you hear Palestine. You don't know how many people are we talking about. We know where it is on the map, of course, but these are some of the numbers. The population of Israel is a little bit under 10 million. It's 9.5 million in Israel. Now, of that group of, you know, and I feel like I kind of want to round up to 10 million just to make it easier. But, and I will then, because we're talking about percentages, 73.5% of Israel are Jews. So again, almost three quarters. We're almost 10 million and it's almost three quarters. And so, you know, however you want to look at this, 21% of Israel, which is about 1.8 million people, are Arabs. If you think that only Jews live in Israel, you are incorrect. There are one out of five people that are in Israel are Arabs. Okay. And then they just, then they say 5% other. I don't know. It's a variety of other people could live there and do live there. The life expectancy in Israel is 82.7 years. It's pretty long. The life expectancy in Palestine is not 82 years. Okay. It's considerably lower than that. There are, so if we're saying that there's just about 10 million people in Israel, then you ask how many Palestinians are there? There are 5.4 million Palestinians. So again, you're for the sake of this, you know, keeping it simple for this discussion, you've got about 10 million Israelis and about 5 million Palestinians, right? So they outnumber them 2-1. Within that group of 5.4 million Palestinians, I mentioned there's two different places where you can be. You can be up north in the West Bank. There are about 3 million Palestinians there. Or you can be down south in Gaza. There are about 2 million Palestinians there. So again, now within this group of 5.4 million, you are, you know, you're kind of like 60% up north, 40% down south. You know, that's the way that the demographics work out. And since, you know, what's been going on recently has been down south in Gaza, right? It hasn't really been an invasion into the West Bank as of the recording of this. I mean, that might change, but for now, it appears that the focus is on Gaza. Listen, there's 2 million people there. That's quite a bit. You know, when you're talking about Gaza, let's talk a little bit about Gaza then, to put it in America-centric concepts that we can understand. Gaza is about 40 square miles. That is roughly the size of Philadelphia. Okay. So if you're somebody in the United States and you're in the Northeast and you've been to New York City, or maybe you live up there and you go down to Philly's big enough that it's got all the four major sports, right? It's got a football team, it's got a basketball team, it's got a hockey team, it's got a baseball team. All right. So it's a major city. And of course, obviously the history of Philadelphia, it doesn't matter necessarily I'm just talking about the size of Philly. I'm talking about the population, you know, something along that size. So it's not huge, right? Gaza's not gigantic. It's reasonably sized. 40 square miles is 40 square miles with 2 million people in it. It's tight. It's pretty tight in there. And of course, the quality of life in there is at the bare minimum of a functioning society. You know, you're talking about like water that doesn't really flow all that often. Food is it's hard to get food in and out. And of course, that has been shut down by the Israelis. So let's talk a little bit about the demographics, because the median age in Gaza is 18 years old. Okay, half the population above, half the population below. To put that in perspective, the worldwide median age average isn't 18 years old, it's 28. So this is a region that is skewing very young. In fact, 47.3% of Gaza is under 18 years old. Again, if we're going to round up and make things easy, let's just say half the population. From 47.3, let's just round up to 50% to keep it simple. Half the population is under 18. That is a very, very interesting demographic trend. If we, and out of the the grand total, I mentioned 5.4 million Palestinians. Out of that 5.4 million, you have almost 2.4 million under the age of 18. So that's combining Gaza and the West Bank. West Bank numbers are similar, 41.7% under 18. So again, it's 40% under, 50% under in Gaza, you know. So it works out to about, you know, just about 2.4 million out of 5.4 million are kids, children. Children, not fighting age men, babies and toddlers and first graders and fifth graders. Not that they're school. I mean, not that they're actually going to get an education, but you know what I'm saying. Kids' age, half of them. So, you know, listen, I ask you this. If you've grown up your entire life in an open air concentration camp and that's all you've ever known, and you're in basically in a prison, and you say, well, who are the wardens? And they say, those people over there. How are you going to feel growing up? I mean, honestly, I have plenty of Jewish friends that I grew up with. I don't have any Palestinian friends to ask. I don't know any Palestinians. My assumption would be the ones that grew up there, if they were to tell me, you know, I don't really love the Israelis all that much, I have a real problem with the Jewish people in the Israel, I would understand. I would say, well, of course you do. I would, if I were in your shoes, if I grew up in an open air prison that is intentionally run at the lowest level allowed by international law and sometimes in violation of international law, how would I grow up having some resentment? You bet I would. Would I grow up to be a terrorist? Well, that depends on how you define terrorist. If it's standing up for the place where you live and trying to push back and wanting higher quality standards, living standards, wanting food and water and wanting the Red Cross and not that the Red Cross is necessarily a force for good, but they have brought a lot of supplies in. But, you know, I would like to, you know, I would feel resentment towards those that were destroying ships that were coming to bring supplies to my area. I'd have a huge problem with that. If I could get close to the, you know, if I got next to the fence, the Israeli fence that they built, and was shot at by the deranged lunatic IDF guards over there that constantly shoot at the Palestinian people. This isn't my opinion. You can watch videos of it. Yeah, I'd grow up with an axe to grind against these oppressors over there. So it just depends on whose side, you know, what perspective you're on, right? But let's also be honest here about what's actually driving this, because there's ideological hate. You know, the Israelis look at the Palestinians and consider them to be insects, so they don't, and they also say, well, this is our land. This was our land to begin with, and I'm not going to get involved in the Holy War or everything. You know, like what your book says, it was your land, and what, I mean, you're reading books that were translated from kings to other kings and from one obscure dialect to another. I mean, a lot gets lost in translation. This is the ultimate game of telephone. And you're going to tell me that, well, my God is better than your God, and my God gave me this land 8,000 years ago. And we've been, it's like, oh, listen, the source material that you're working off, I have questions about. Okay. You're going to need to show me the deed to the property, right? Before I just believe you. And let's be fair, the Israelis are pathological liars when it comes to stuff like this. They're constantly lying. They shouldn't be trusted about anything. So you say, well, what is this really about? Well, I'll tell you what it could be about. There's a shitload of oil offshore, right off the coast of Gaza. Did you know that? And in the West Bank region. We knew about that. Pipeline plans running through there. Does the company Genie Energy ring a bell? It should. It should. It's an oil company operating in Israel, operating, you know, stealing oil in Syria, run by the Cheney, you know, Cheney Zionist media oil company guys. This is a company run by, well, now it's, you know, now it's run by the people that run oil companies, but boards of directors founded, put together. Would you like to hear the list of the people that have put together Genie Energy, that most definitely are drilling for oil in Israel and stealing oil in Syria? I mean, that with the cooperation of the United States government. Well, who's behind Genie Energy? Because if you know who's behind Genie Energy, I think that you might understand that this is a little bit more than just some obscure holy book that you're going off of. This is about business, baby. This is about making a lot of money. And there's a shitload of oil there. And these guys want it. So who's behind Genie Energy? Oh, nobody. Just James Woolsey, former CIA director. Bill Richardson, former... Congressman from New Mexico, Epstein's best friend, doesn't matter, he's dead now. Jacob Rothschild is behind Genie Energy. Hardcore Zionist Michael Steinhardt, one of the mega group guys, he's involved in that. Rupert Murdoch, mega group Zionist, involved in that. Dick Cheney, involved. Adolf Hitler, no? Couldn't get him on the board of directors? That's weird. He would have been a good fit. Let's talk about the other side of the equation. Let's talk about Hamas, right? This is all the rage these days, talking about Hamas. I mean, if you listen to Amy Schumer, comedian, and I use that term very loosely, comedian Amy Schumer, joke thief Amy Schumer, she would have you believe that Hamas are insects as well, that should just be shot any chance they get. Scott Horton would describe Hamas as the toughest prison gang. You know, the Israelis say, well, you guys voted for Hamas. Yeah. Like Scott says, it's not that the people necessarily of the Palestinian people necessarily love Hamas. It's they're terrified of them. They are the toughest prison gang in the open air prison. And they run the place. So like they're elected. The way that Black Gorilla Family or the Aryan Brotherhood is elected to run Pelican Bay, right? I mean, are they your favorite choice? No, but given the current situation that you're in, you kind of need somebody that gets business done. You kind of need somebody that the other side is at least a little bit scared of, right? And so you have Hamas. So it's not to say that the Palestinian people are enthusiastic supporters of Hamas. Maybe some of them are. Let me rephrase that. Some of them are. For sure some of them are. Doesn't mean all of them are. I mean, again, if somebody were to say to you, like, the American government, you know, America is behind all of these, you know, the destruction of Ukraine and America needs to die because of that, you would say, please differentiate between the American government and the American people, because we didn't want this. We're not involved in this. And so same thing, same rules apply. When you're talking about Hamas, please differentiate between the Palestinian people and Hamas. Sometimes they're the same, but not always. And there's plenty of Palestinians that are held hostage by Hamas. But who is Hamas, right? Let's talk about that. Because in order to understand this, you've got to get very clear on who Hamas actually is. Not what the media tells you, not what the Zionist-controlled media tells you. And that's not a derogatory term. That is a political designation by those Israelis. They are Zionists. And the ones running the media inside the United States are a component of that. They are Zionists. That is their political affiliation. And that political affiliation is that the Israeli state needs to take over everything. That's what they want in that region. So again, that's their ideology. It's not a religion. It's not a religious kind. This is not a shitting on Jewish people thing. This is it, any more so than it is to say that, like, you know, I'm shitting on Christians by criticizing Republicans. There's for sure you are, but you can understand differences. And you've got to do this song and dance when it comes to this stuff, because so everybody is so sensitive about it. But I don't give a fuck. Let's have the conversation. Hamas was started by the Israeli Mossad. Okay, period, end of story. Not debatable, not my opinion, not speculation, not, oh, I think this could be the case, not, oh, I got bad info, not, I read this on TikTok, or I saw this on TikTok, or I read it on Reddit. No. Hamas was started by the Israeli Mossad. That is like the equivalent of the Israeli CIA. The reason why they were started is to use them as a counterbalance, as controlled opposition. Now, when you talk about controlled opposition, it doesn't mean that you control the opposition and make them do nothing towards you. You instead get what Benjamin Netanyahu describes when he talks about controlling Hamas. He says, quote, "We control the height of the flame." Okay. So it's not so much that you can make them do nothing. It's that you can, when you need them to, you can turn that from a simmer to a boil when you need them to. When you're Benjamin Netanyahu and you're just about to be put in prison for your crimes against your own people, when your government hates your, when the general public hates your guts and the government is starting to turn on you and you need a distraction and you need to look like the hero and you need to look like some guy who's tough on the Palestinians, you turn the height of the flame that he has admitted he controls, you turn it up. You turn it up. So when Hamas is created, it's created by the Israeli Mossad. And it was financed originally by Iran. I think that financing has really pivoted more to Qatar. They're in charge of the financing of this. But what you get is controlled opposition. Now, it's not a concept that I developed or came up with. This is something that's been around a long time. Here's the concept of why you would start controlled opposition. Think of it like this. You know that you are about to do some unspeakable shit to a country real close to you. You're going to do something that is going to be rightly viewed as being unacceptable. There's going to be a lot of pushback. There's going to be a lot of people mad at you for doing what you do. So you know you're about to have enemies. You probably have these enemies already, but you know you're about to have some real anger towards you. But that doesn't stop you, of course. You're still going to do what you're going to do because you're a psychopathic government, like the Israeli government. So in advance of doing the thing that you know will rightly get you a ton of criticism, you create a group that will lead the charge in the criticism towards you. There's no sense trying to prevent a group like that from coming to power. It's going to happen whether you want it to or not. You're going to do diabolical shit. You know what the response is going to be. People are going to be angry. So your choices are either don't do that in the first place, or if you're going to do it, then you better make sure you control the other side. You better make sure you control the reaction to that. You better make sure that when they form a terrorist group to come back and get you, that you secretly control that terrorist group. And that is Hamas. And that's just the easy version of it. It's controlled opposition. Now, again, that doesn't mean that what Hamas doesn't mean they don't mean it. They're rightly angry at Israel. And Israel is angry at the Palestinians, right? So there's anger. This is authentic anger. I'm not trying to say that's manufactured, but you can control the size of the flame. And listen, if this wasn't the case, then why would we have, up to just 4 years ago, Benjamin Netanyahu on camera with a microphone, presumably not on drugs, saying and describing Hamas as, quote, an asset, and saying we have to actively support them? Why would you do that? Why would you support the bad guys if you didn't control the bad guys? Of course. I mean, nobody's going to accuse the Israelis of being dumb or not strategic. I mean, they're playing 4D chess. You know what I mean? Like, it at times. But of course, their anger gets in the way. And ultimately, their psychopathy is exposed these days. The world is turning against Israel. I think a lot of people didn't love them to begin with, but they didn't say anything about it. I think whether you're a nation or you're some kid in college, you know what I mean? I think that it's open season now for people to express themselves a little bit more, I don't know, vocally about how they feel about Israel. They're not loved. In fact, the worst strategic move America can participate in is to be intimately aligned with Israel. It's a strategic blunder. If America wanted to improve its international relations overnight, they would designate Israel a terrorist organization, which is what they are. And let me ask you this, because again, you have to look back at the 1967 USS Liberty attack, in which Israel intentionally attacked a US ship knowingly. You can listen to the radio, you can listen to the air traffic control conversations where they're telling them, the pilot saying, "I can see American flags. Are you sure you want, this is an American ship, are you sure?" And they're saying, "Do it." Lyndon Johnson saying, "I want that ship at the bottom of the ocean." Okay, do you understand? Israel is not our ally, whether it's the USS Liberty or whether it's 9/11. And again, it wasn't just Israel. That was also the United States. It's these people I just listed. It's Dick Cheney, Rupert Murdoch, Michael Steinhardt, Bill Richardson, James Wolseley, all these guys. These are the 9/11 crew. Some of them are American Zionists. Some of them are Israeli Zionists. But these two countries did 9/11. Okay, so you have to keep that in mind when you're trying to, you know, figure out where you stand on the Israel-Palestine thing. You can be against Israel's policies, but you not necessarily have to support the Palestinians in the same way. Again, economic minister of Israel recently described Hamas as, quote, an asset. Here we go again. Now we've got more than one person, high-ranking person inside the Israeli government. We've got Benjamin Netanyahu, the top of the pyramid. Saying that they're an asset, describing them as an asset, saying they control the height of the flame. Look, this is well known. This is well known to people in positions, but I'm not saying everybody, I'm not saying people in Israel understand this. I'm not saying that the Palestinian people understand this, and certainly not the Americans. They don't understand the role of Hamas. But if you are a high ranking person in the Israeli government or military, you know this. You understand what this is. You know what this is. Epstein's control files still probably have a few holdovers and stragglers on it, I would imagine. I just listened to who in Congress is the most vocal supporters of it. That'll give you an idea of who's on the Lolita Express. A lot of people very, you know, almost enthusiastically. If you ever see the mid-80s conference, I guess I would call it a conference, in Iraq, you can find this footage of it. It's wild. Saddam is up there, like on the stage, sitting at a table, and he's saying, "There are traitors in our midst. There are traitors in our midst." And the place is packed. It's like two levels. And then you can see the cameras kind of panning. There's multiple cameras there. And you can tell what it is. It's like grainy video sort of. And you can see these guards coming down and grabbing people one at a time. And they're like, no, I didn't, you know, and they're like taking them off. And then you see a bunch of other people standing up, and then it becomes performance art. It's, "You get those guys. I want to be the most vocal person. Allah loves Saddam, praise Saddam." And they're like, all these people are like tripping over themselves to like be the first person to stand up and say, "We love Saddam," and kill those people that you're pulling out of there. That's what it feels like in Congress. It's a bunch of people, they cannot stand up. They'd stand on their seats and applaud Israel if they could. Marjorie Taylor Greene and all these so-called freedom people, Chuck Schumer, Adam Schiff. I mean, these guys are dual Israeli citizens, so they don't need to have the control files on them. They're already in it, but there's probably control files on them just to make sure. But, you have to think strategically about this. And this is the problem I have with this blowback concept, is that, not the concept, but what is going on in the Middle East right now is creating a scenario in which I'm getting World War One, the lead up to World War One vibes from this. And let me tell you why. In the lead up to World War One, you have Serbia and you have Austria Archduke Franz Ferdinand assassinated and all this stuff, right? It starts off kind of a regional conflict between these two nations. Nothing overwhelming, right? It's not Germany versus Russia or anything. It's just, it's a small regional war. But here's the connection. Here's the overlap between what we're seeing now and the lead up to World War I. Similarities are that they had these countries, whether it be Serbia or Austria, have these mutual defense pacts with neighboring countries. It's where they say, listen, if somebody invades us, say Austria and Hungary, let's just say, somebody invades us, will you come to our defense? And Hungary says, yeah. And they say, all right, fine. If somebody invades you, we'll come to your defense. Let's put it in writing, right? So you've got those going on between a few countries in the lead up to World War I. So once you start to have this break out and one of them gets involved, Austria, then they have to say to Hungary, hey, remember that treaty, that pact that we signed, that mutual defense thing? We're being attacked. We need you to jump in. So they jump in. But here's the problem. They have a pact with another country as well. Hungary, let's just as an example, I'm using this as an example. Hungary jumps in. They say, all right, well, we've signed this pact with you. So here you are. Now it's us. You know, now we'll help you fight. But we've got a pact with somebody else. So now they're in. And so then you look at the other side of the equation on this fight, say Serbia in the World War I example. Who do they have mutual defense pacts with? So they've got a couple as well. So now they're in. So this, now it turns into a gang fight. Now it turns into, you know, you're going to beat up, you know, I'm going to go home and get my brother, my big brother. And then your big brother comes up and the other guy went and got his big brother. And now his big brother shows up and his big brother goes and gets the rest of the guys from the football team. Well, the other side, that guy's big brother goes and gets everybody from the baseball team. You know what I mean? And next thing you know, you've got yourself a massive brawl. And this is my fear with regard to this situation in the buildup to a potential World War III, is that you've got Israel and Hamas going at it, right? You've got Israel bombing Gaza. Using U.S. money, of course, you know, it's hard to say. We give them $3 billion. We, America, the American Empire, not me, give the Israelis $3 billion a year that we know of. I mean, God knows how much other stuff is going that direction, how much Israelis are stealing technology from America. That's been a big thing. They love to steal our software. They've been doing that since I don't know, probably before the Inslaw situation, the book that Danny Castellaro wrote called The Octopus, describing the Inslaw situation that wound up getting him killed. So you've got U.S. dollars flowing to Israel. You've got Israeli bombs being dropped on Gaza. You've got the Palestinian, you've got Hamas saying, listen, you know, if you fight us, you know, we have backers too. What about if Hezbollah in Lebanon decides that they're going to jump in on this? Now's the time to do it. Now you see it's not to say that Hezbollah and Hamas are necessarily friends or ideologically aligned, but the enemy of my enemy is, you know, you have a mutual enemy in Israel, right? So maybe now's the time to get involved. So if Hezbollah jumps in, Iran has said that they will, that they'll, Iran is helping to finance Hezbollah. They said by treaty, they'll jump in. They have an arrangement. They have to jump in, Iran. Now, Iran has another, so this is what I'm saying. It's like you bring a country in because of your treaty, but that country has treaties with other countries. And so next thing you know, it's the football team and the baseball team all fighting, right? So you're Hamas and you say, we need help. Hezbollah, can you jump in from the north? Hezbollah jumps in from the north. They start to get into it with Israel. Hezbollah's got Iran's backing. So now Iran is involved in this. Iran is part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which requires everybody to fight like NATO. So now, next thing you know, Iran has signed this deal with China and Russia. Now, China and Russia are legally obligated to get involved because of the SCO that that they're a member of, right? And then what about Turkey, right? Turkey has no love for Israel at all. It can't stand them, but they're a member of NATO. So in Article 5 of NATO says if one country of NATO is attacked, all of them have to jump in. So this is some gangland bullshit. This is the, you know, 28th Street Hoover Crips type of bullshit. You fight one of them, you got to fight all of them, right? So this is the problem with this region, is that if it were just Israel against Palestine, Gaza in particular, Hamas in particular in there, that would be one thing. It'd be terrible and it would be awful. And it's terrible for the Palestinian people. It's terrible for the Israeli people as well. The governments are a different story, but it's bad for all the human people, no matter what. But it has the potential to spread, not just because other countries want to get involved, not because there's political pressure. It might be legally that they have to. So this is the part about, look, this is blowback that lights the fuse on World War III in the Middle East, right? What is blowback? Negative repercussions affecting a country whose government has undertaken a usually clandestine intelligence operation in a foreign country. There's going to be blowback against the United States for this. Let's talk. Well, first, let's talk about a little bit about Western Europe, UK and Western Europe. We had Dan Lyman on from Border Hawk News and InfoWars Europe a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about the border crisis, not just in the United States, but also in Western Europe. And Dan's a good dude, and he was based in Switzerland for 6 years while running InfoWars Europe. And one of the things that he was involved with was trying to figure out what the situation was with these migrants, these North African and Middle Eastern migrants that were coming up through Turkey and up the eastern side of the Mediterranean into Italy, into Croatia, Serbia, Bosnia, places like that. And what was happening there was that the police in Croatia were picking up these guys, and they were finding that they all had a common denominator besides being migrants. They all had these debit cards. And these debit cards were interesting. So Dan's team did, I think, the equivalent of a European Freedom of Information Act request or something. And they were able to get the documentation showing that the credit cards, the debit cards that these people were given were coming from the Open Society Foundation, which is George Soros. And it was through a partnership with MasterCard, a $500 million partnership with MasterCard. MasterCard, a member of the World Economic Forum. So you go, okay, well, so Soros is and MasterCard are making sure that all of these migrants have debit cards to get here. But you can't really, at some point you'll spend it all, right? It's so what was interesting about this was that the debit cards were being replenished every month. So it wasn't just a one shot. It wasn't like you bought, somebody gave you a Starbucks gift card for $50 for Christmas and then you used it up and then you throw it away. There's no more. In this case, those cards were being reloaded with more money next month. And so Dan's crew was trying to figure out who's reloading them. And that was where they found out that it was the EU, the European Union, was behind refilling these cards. So you go, okay, wait a second. Okay, you're the one, you know, it's the Scooby-Doo moment where you pull the mask off. You pull the mask off the bad guy and you go, wait, it's the, who's destroying Europe? You pull the mask off and you go, the EU's destroying Europe? Wait a second. You're supposed to be protecting Europe, right? Oh, come on now. You know better than to think that, right? This is all nonsense. So you have to understand that there's blowback happening in Europe as well. There's countries that are allowing these migrants that are definitely being made to flow from North Africa and the Middle East into Western Europe. we've got the rapes in Sweden. You know about that. You're not allowed to talk about that. If you talk about the rapes in Sweden that are being conducted by the Middle Eastern men, then you're a bigot for noticing, right? Germany's a mess. Germany's a mess. Their energy's a mess because we blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. Talk about blowback. Talk about blowback in a figurative and literal sense is that. So Germany's a mess. Good luck trying to export BMWs and Porsches to places when you don't have any power. That's a problem. Should have thought about that before you got in bed with NATO and the United States, psychopaths. Hungary said no way. They said no way. And guess why the globalists hate Viktor Orban so much? Because he said, we're not doing this. He put big fences up. He built the wall. It's going to be huge. He built the wall and he told everybody, oh, all you people that think you're coming to Hungary, you can fuck right off. Go somewhere else. You're not coming in here. You're not welcome. And so they went somewhere else and the globalists were like, how dare you? And he's like, how dare I? Look, I'm looking out for my people. You know, the people that are already here, we're good. When we need to import labor, we'll import labor. But by the way, the people that are coming, it is, they are fighting age males. Okay. I mean, that is, I know that that gets talked about a lot and people try to be dismissive of it. Where are the women in the videos? Where are the women and the children? There are some children, of course, they're getting trafficked, but for the most part, it's men that don't bring a ton to the table. Oh, you've got a PhD in mechanical engineering. You're coming to Hungary. No, you don't. Then get the fuck out. Keep walking. You have no skills. You don't speak the language. You bring nothing to the table. You're not educated. Why would we want you in here? No offense, but like, why would we? Think about it strategically. You're not needed. Unless you're getting replaced, but you're not allowed to talk about the great replacement theory without being fitted for a fucking swastika. You know what I mean? So they have to control also your ability to discuss this. They can't have you talking about this. I mean, it's reality. You see it with your own eyes, especially if you're in the UK. I mean, how do you think people in the UK in these smaller cities feel knowing that Serco is picking up 5-year leases for all of the apartments and all of the rental homes that they can get their hands on in these small to mid-sized cities in England and putting migrants there that are coming from Dover that they're picking up there as they cross the English Channel, corralling all of them, putting them in a Serco-run detention facility, getting them documentation, and then relocating them into apartments that Serco's being paid, Serco's managing at the behest of the UK government, of course, and installing these migrants, illegal immigrants. I think they're migrants until they get into your border and then they become illegal immigrants, and whatever. Taking them and treating them better than you treat your own people. All right, people see this. People understand this. So again, when you watch your government, when you watch an intelligence operation in a foreign country and you wonder about the concept of blowback, you think you're not going to have blowback in Western Europe for what's been done? Of course you are. You can't say it. You can't say that white people in England are being replaced. You can't say that. God forbid. You're not allowed to notice it, but it's true and it's happening. What about blowback for, I don't know, but blowback on America and NATO over the Nord Stream pipeline? You know, I mean, again, if you're listening to this in Germany, how pissed are you right now? You have totally self-immolated your country on the altar of NATO to fight a proxy war against Russia through Ukraine. And you did that. You slit your own throat and allowed your own oil and gas deals that you had with Russia to go away. You allowed the Nord Stream pipeline to be blown up. And now what? Now are you making up the difference for that liquefied natural gas? You're buying it from the United States at 4 times the price. Congratulations. Great job. I mean, how do you feel about America if you're in Germany right now and you've watched? I mean, you really direct your frustration at first towards your German government because they're the ones dealing with the American government. I mean, it's not Americans, of course, that are doing this, but But the idea that the Germans are just watching us going, what are we doing? What are we doing to ourselves? Yeah, it's a... why did we sign this suicide pact with NATO? Like, we get it if somebody's attacking us, but they're not attacking one of our members. Russia isn't attacking NATO. They're attacking Ukraine. So, but I don't have a legal, I don't have the legal handcuffs on me that says I have to get into this fight because Ukraine is not a NATO member. So Germany's like, why'd you drag us into this? It screwed up the factories, screwed up the, I mean, there was last winter, there were people that were out like cutting down trees. They were like, we're going to have to figure something out to our energy needs. Good job. You know, what about the blowback on NATO in general, in America in particular, as the rest of the world watched you guys throw Russia off of the SWIFT banking system platform and then steal $300 billion of their dollar reserves? You think that the rest of the world doesn't talk? Like that India doesn't see what's happening with Russia and think, you know, we're one lunatic away from the same thing happening to us. They put somebody, they install some new Biden puppet who's got a axe to grind with India, and next thing you know, they're stealing our money and putting and kicking us off the SWIFT banking system, right? So you know, the world is watching. You know, blowback comes in a variety of forms and fashions. I mean, we start off by talking about the Middle East, but quickly now we're talking about Western Europe. We're talking about Eastern Europe too. We're talking about all those countries going, oh, I see what happens when you get on the wrong side of the American Empire. They steal all your stuff. They're just common criminals. They're just thieves. So, you know, what was the blowback on Russia? You know, Russia got involved in the Ukraine situation and, you know, taking back parts of their ethnically Russian regions. Again, unprovoked Russian attack is what we were told here in the West. Of course, it was provoked. It had been provoked since 2014 and frankly, since 2004. So what happened with Russia? Well, in Russia's case, the blowback was positive. They were thinking strategically. America refuses to do that anymore. But the Russians, it forced them to back the ruble with gold. 1 gram of gold for every 5,000 rubles. Brilliant idea. It forced them to... They'd always been part of BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, but that alliance tightened, got even closer. It expanded. It added 7 new countries. It's expanding even further from there. There's like a dozen or more that are in some form of application to become part of BRICS. So, you know, the blowback in this particular case of the Ukraine war and the sanctions against Russia strengthened Russia because we did it wrong. Because we did it. There's no right way to sanction Russia and everything, but because we did that, they had to pivot. We forced them into the arms of China, tighter. We forced them to start exploring relationships of selling oil to India. India is now buying 30 times more oil and gas from Russia than they were before. Congratulations. We forced them into a gold-backed, you know, the gold-backed ruble works so well at shoring up the value of their currencies that they said, why don't we do a gold-backed BRICS currency? Now, it's not a consumer-level currency. It's more interstate trade. But nevertheless, proof of concept. And I'll tell you this, accepting oil in exchange for selling oil in exchange for Indian rupees or this gold-backed BRICS currency, those are things that would rightly have gotten you invaded in the past by the American Empire. You can't invade, the American Empire spread too thin. Can't do it now. What are you going to do? Invade India? Good luck with that, you know? They've decided, no, we're going to buy gas in something other than U.S. dollars, and you can't stop us. And the rest of the countries in the world are starting to feel emboldened now. because they're seeing that, that now's the time to get away from this. And look, let's not underestimate the fact that Russia and India and China and Iran and Saudi Arabia, they all play a role in the Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's half-century plan for building a land-based Silk Road. We've done a whole episode on that. If people want to go back about a year or so, you can find the Belt and Road Initiative episode where we go into extreme detail about the overland train rail lines that are being developed and the maritime routes that are connecting from port to port, Southeast Asia, South Asia, the Middle East, parts of eastern parts of Africa, and even through the Suez and up into the Mediterranean and up through the Adriatic of Italy and Croatia up there, and connecting into North Italy. You know, so the Belt and Road Initiative is a huge component of this. Let's talk about financial blowback too, because I think that you know, when you print 80% of all dollars into existence just in the last half decade, there are ramifications for that. This is economics and math. It's not opinion. You cannot do that. If you took a 2-liter bottle of Coke and you added and you dumped it into a bucket, okay, and then you added 4 2-liter bottles of water to that bucket, how do you think your Coke would taste? It wouldn't be the same. It's diluted. And when you've got 80% of all dollars being brought into existence just in the last 5 years, you have diluted the money supply. It means that every unit of currency is worth a little bit, a lot less. And you can play that game as long as there's demand for the currency. And you create artificial demand for the currency. Well, if theoretically, if you're playing it right, there's just natural demand for it. But America doesn't play the game right. They have to create artificial demand for it. That's the petrodollar arrangement. Everybody in the world, any of you guys want to buy any oil from these OPEC nations, you got to convert it to dollars first, and then with dollars, you can buy it. That makes the dollar valuable. That makes it necessary and needed. This is not a surprise. This has been the arrangement for 50 years. But what if that arrangement goes away? What if those OPEC nations say, you don't have to use dollars, you can use something else? Now, companies or countries may feel comfortable still conducting transactions in dollars because they've always been used to doing that. But you have to imagine that there's a few countries that say, oh, well, now's our chance to buy oil without using the dollar. If you want us to use it and you're awful to us, the American empire are awful to our people or maybe our region, we're not going to play your game now that we don't have to. And that's where we are. So as these countries start to pivot and start to settle oil trades in something other than the petrodollar, the demand and desire for the petrodollar falls. That would be bad enough. But you add that into the dilution of the money supply already with the COVID money and what Trump did and what Biden's been doing and all of the presidents, really. But really, in the last 5 years, you've seen nothing but chaos with regard to the what's happened to the money supply. $33 trillion in debt. Who gives a shit? You know, nobody cares, right? COVID financial policies come out. They disproportionately screw small and medium-sized businesses, put them out. I mean, there's a lot of people that are suffering, and the dollar is falling apart, and it's being done intentionally. So people are pissed, and they have reason to be pissed. The financial blowback of this hasn't even been felt yet. So we have that to look forward to, which is fun. I mean, the United States, since Biden's failed withdrawal from Afghanistan, and look, I'm always in favor of us getting out of countries. Not that we actually really ever left Afghanistan, but since we have overtly left when O'Biden, as Mel Kay calls him, because she believes that Obama is running Biden's administration, and I don't disagree. But the O'Biden regime, since they left Afghanistan, you know how much money they've sent to Afghanistan since they left? The $85 billion worth of equipment wasn't quite enough. They have sent $11 billion in cash to Afghanistan since the withdrawal, to the Taliban. You've seen the meme, right? How we replaced the Taliban with the Taliban over 20 years. People are pissed. People understand this. They see what's going on. The southern border is wide open. Wide open. Welded open in places. Nobody's talking about it like it's a priority, you know? But we're starting to see some blowback. We're starting to see some blowback from the border policy. You're starting to see the Chicago Blacks very angry at the Venezuelan Browns that are taking up all of the beds in the gymnasiums and the food and the attention and the money and the love and the special treatment from the existing group. So the Chicago Blacks are now mad at the Venezuelans and others that have come up. And so now they're fighting with one another. Oh, now you're not a protected class anymore. You've been discarded by the Democrats, by the Pritzker administration in Illinois, or the Susan Hochul, horse-faced loser administration in the state of New York. And you're acting surprised that the immigrants are being treated better than you, being given more stuff. What did you think was going to happen? You think these people give a shit about you? You're a tool to them that they can use. You've become an irrelevant tool. The Black community in Chicago, I hate to break it to you, you're no longer needed. They've found a new version of people that they can weaponize and use as a political tool, the Democrats have. And those are the immigrants that are being bussed there. That's what so you should have gotten what you could have gotten when you could have gotten it, Blacks in Chicago. Because you're not getting it anymore. Now you're on your own. I mean, but luckily you have that great public school education that Chicago is known for priding itself on delivering, you know, where nobody in 50 of the public schools was proficient in reading and math. You know that education? I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you kept all your textbooks, because the state of Illinois has pivoted. They no longer care about you. They're now focused on their new toy, which is the immigrants being brought up and installed in their cities and state. This is the direction it's going, right? And listen, I mean, the Trilateral Commission is rigging the detonators as we speak on the American empire. That's why you've got 7+ million people that have come through the southern border in just the last couple of years. I mean, expect sleeper cells, right? You don't have to do too much calculation on this. You know, you understand that they're trying to destabilize the United States. So this is what they do. The wheels have fallen off. You've got armies of people coming up through the southern border. Why do you think they're coming in? Why do you think that that's being allowed to happen? You want to talk about blowback. When the American people finally figure out what the plan is with these immigrants all along, it's going to be a civil war. Maybe. Hopefully not. I'm anti-war. Don't want the war. What I really want is for all these lunatics to be rounded up. The lunatics in government, I should say. But listen, you're going to start hearing the term sleeper cells. They're going to call them Hamas. They'll definitely say it's Hamas. Whether it is or isn't doesn't matter. That's what they're going to tell you that they are, because that's part of the narrative that they want you to believe. I mean, if I've learned nothing over the last 10 years of being involved in this, it's that they love to get like two or three for ones, right? They can get domestic terrorism. That ticks a box. They can make sure that the domestic terrorists were using AR-15s. That ticks a box. If we can call them members of Hamas, that ticks a box. You know, maybe they're one-legged non-binary Hamas, which would really be something. They can't help themselves. So you're going to, I mean, and of course it won't really be necessarily them. It will be the FBI pulling the puppet strings on them, feeding them with the information that they need, feeding, giving them the weapons, training them, you know, doing the things that you need to do. We've already seen Patriot Front. We've already seen that joke of an organization out there marching. And they want you to be really fearful of these clowns that are straight out of Quantico, but we're not, because we see clearly what this is. This is obvious, but it's going to be less obvious when it's a bunch of brown people. And you've got white America freaked out and they don't know who's who. And they can't tell the difference between a Mexican and a Venezuelan and a Palestinian. You know what I mean? The average American after 9/11, there were people that were beating Sikhs because they saw them wearing turbans and they associated turban with Islam, even though there's no connections. Americans in large groups are dangerous, okay? Because they're not really bright and they act like a herd and you have to be careful. But I can envision a scenario in which they have said that the term sleeper cell is ingrained into the public lexicon. It's coming because you can feel it, how they're already laying the narrative groundwork there. If you know what to look for, you can see this thing coming a mile away. The Venezuelan prisoners, we've talked about them and the mentally ill that Venezuela opened up their mental insane asylums and their prisons. And they said, hey, you guys want a free trip, a one-way ticket to the southern border of the United States? Well, today's your lucky day. So they're going to be weaponized and used, much like all these terror cells, these sleeper cells that are going to be activated inside the United States. But I've got bad news for them. Because I've seen the end, I've read the end of this story. I know how it ends for those people. They don't know because they don't know anything about history. But we know. We know what happens to the brown shirts. The brown shirts are used to destabilize and destroy society from the inside. This is the destruction process. Yuri Bezmenov talked about the 2 to 5 year destruction process. But remember what he said when the crisis event happens. And then the normalization process comes in. The agitators, the brown shirts in Hitler's case, those people become alive. They're an asset on the way up because they destabilize the status quo and they allow for this new group to come in and take power. They're an asset in the early stages and they're a liability in the later stages, because once you've had this change of power in this revolution, those agitators are still agitated. And they will destroy this new incarnation of the government if you allow them to stick around. But they never allow them to stick around. They do what is always done to the brown shirts. They're put up against the wall and shot. So the Venezuelan prisoners and the mentally ill and the people that are being allowed to come across the southern border and the ones that are being trained and the ones that are going to be part of these sleeper cells, enjoy your time in America while you can. Because it's going to end very badly for you. Because the administration will have no problem putting you up against the wall and shooting you when the time is right. They always forget how the story ends. But you know, it always ends the same way. With piles of dead bodies and ultimately with them being put up against the wall. Got to understand your history. Hey, if you like this episode, you can take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can find me on Twitter at macroaggressions, the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody. I'll talk to you again soon.